The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily reflect those of 55KRC, The Talk Station, and Clear Channel Worldwide.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio, Cincinnati's only gun talk show. Join us. We're going to explore the topic of firearms and your rights as a law-abiding citizen. Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. Now here's your host, John Johnston, on 55KRZ, the talk station.
Good evening and welcome to Ballistic Radio, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown, your source for premium firearms and ammunition. I can't speak tonight. I'm your host, John Johnston. As always, check out ballisticradio.com and facebook.com/ballisticradio. Also, please check out my friend's charity, rampagefortthecure.org. It's always cool to donate to cancer research while acknowledging how awesome Archer is. Anyway, tonight we're going to be talking with law enforcement officer John Hearn, who's one of the leading experts on the 1986 FBI Miami firefight. And that's something that everyone really should be familiar with if you're into guns at all, because it changed the face of the industry. It's probably one of the most studied events in modern law enforcement. It changed how cops do things, changed how gun manufacturers, specifically ammo manufacturers, do things. And tonight we're going to be discussing what happened, the best we can tell, and like I said, the ramifications of that event. So without further ado, I'm just going to get John on the line because we got a lot of information to pack in here, not much time to do it. So let's see. Mr. John Hearn, how are you doing this night?
I'm doing great tonight, John. How about you?
Hey, not too bad. Looks like we ended up doing the cell phone anyway, so I guess you win.
I'm just glad to be here.
Hey, I'm glad we didn't have more phone problems than we did. So, if you don't mind, just give the listeners a brief summary of your background and what made you start studying this gunfight.
Well, I've been a law enforcement officer since about 1992. I started out part-time and picked up a master's degree. So I kind of have this, I would questionably hidden, nerdy academic side in the background. I've been full-time as a law enforcement officer since 2001, primarily in patrol, doing a lot of training for my agency, teach firearms, basic tactics, that sort of thing. I've also been a staff instructor for Tom Givens out in Range Master, traveling around the country with him. So I've been able to attend a lot of good training along the way. That's kind of my background real quick. As far as why I studied this fight, it's really simple. When the 25th anniversary of the Miami FBI massacre rolled around, Tom said, we're going to make it a focus of our annual tactical conference, and you will be doing a presentation on it. And so I said, thank you, Tom. I will carry forth.
Nice. So obviously there's a lot of stuff that we're going to cut out of this. And if the listeners are interested, they can do more research online as well or attend one of your lectures that you give. But briefly, I guess, what's the background of this gunfight? What led up to this?
Well, the FBI was in a really bad situation. They had some very serious bad guys operating in the Miami. The FBI knew of crimes that had been taking place over a period of about 7 months, and these were what we'd probably call hyper-violent guys, and they were really trying to get these guys captured. So what led up to this fight was I would call it a Hail Mary surveillance operation. Mm-hmm. It was the third time the FBI had just kind of gone out as a possible investigatory route, trying to just kind of be in the area where these guys were known to operate. So this was actually their third attempt, which is forgotten by a lot of people when they kind of try to understand why this event unfolded the way it did.
Right. So they had been on this detail for a little bit, and this was a special unit within the FBI Miami office?
Yeah, this was their criminal squad, the guys that were primarily responsible for dealing with the violent criminals, the guys that were doing the kidnapping, the bank robberies, that sort of thing.
Okay, so we've got some bank robberies that have occurred. We've also got some murders and kidnappings. I guess specifically, they attempted to murder a gentleman and thought they had succeeded and stole his car, and he survived and gave a description of them?
Yeah, that was Jose Colazzo, another interesting story we probably don't have the time for, but basically he was out shooting at a rock pit gravel area out in the Everglades there and ran across these two guys. In the course of their exchange, they shot him twice in the chest and twice in the head. And he ended up fighting with him for a while before he passed out. But he was actually able to survive that, walked himself out of the Everglades, and was able to get medical assistance, and was literally the next day helping out the FBI artist making a composite drawing.
Nice, And that just goes to show that if you like to go shoot on rural land, it might be a good idea to have a firearm loaded at all times, just because you never know who's going to roll up on you. I'll talk about that a different show. So we've got a stolen car, and the FBI knows that there's two guys and what they look like. So start us out on that morning. What happens?
Well, like I said, it's the third attempt, and it's 8:45 in the morning when they do a briefing. The on-scene shift supervisor is Gordon McNeil. He kind of explains what they're in for. And literally less than a half hour later at nine, or actually 32 minutes later, lo and behold, I think pretty much to everybody's surprise, they actually spot the stolen vehicle driving down South Dixie Highway.
Nice. So was there a particular reason they were doing surveillance on Friday mornings? I mean...
Yeah, what was happening was when they looked at the pattern of the armed robberies and the attempted armored car holdups, there was this amazing coincidence where they had all taken place on Fridays between 9:30 and 12:30. I guess that's what we would call a clue.
Right. Hey, makes sense to me. So they spot this stolen vehicle. What kind of occurs? We've got a couple more minutes before the break. Talking with John Hearn about the FBI Miami gunfight in 1986. Please continue.
All right. The two agents that recognize the vehicle, they match the tag. They see it's occupied with the kind of guys they're looking for. So the radio call goes out. Now, they've had to spread their agents out. They had 14 agents assigned to 10 vehicles spread out over about 5 miles of urban highway. And, again, this is 9 o'clock in the morning, so there's still a lot of traffic in the area. So when the call goes out that they've potentially located it, all of a sudden they're trying to bring agents from, you know, some pretty good distances, trying to rally up and try to figure out how they're going to take down these guys. The car turns off this very busy urban highway and ends up in a nice upscale, upper-class neighborhood. And as the agents are kind of assembling, trying to get their stuff together, kind of this caravan is kind of probably unintentionally constructed. And the bad guys figure out pretty quickly that the police are behind them.
Okay. So they spot the cops, the FBI agents. Speaking of, was local law enforcement involved in this or in the initial fight?
Not in the initial. You know, when the FBI realized who they had, they obviously notified the locals, and the Metro-Dade Police Department was responding at the time, but they didn't arrive until the gunfight was well in progress.
Okay. So we've got all the FBI converging on this stolen vehicle, and the suspects in the vehicle have spotted the FBI agents. We've got another minute and 15 seconds if you want to go from there, and then I'll catch you off when the commercial's time.
All right. Well, basically what happens is Gordon McNeil actually passes frontally in front of the bad guys and actually gets to witness the real, real bad guy in this, McNeil. Actually, he sees him inserting a rifle into a long gun and radios that message to the FBI agents on scene. He basically says something to the effect that it looks like these guys are getting ready to go now.
Okay.
So that probably led to his decision to go and initiate the stop.
All right. So the I guess that was that Platt that was loading the long gun? Or Maddox?
Yes, that was Platt. He was okay. In the passenger seat of the bad guy's car.
Right. So we've got these two individuals, and we haven't named them yet, but Platt and Maddox. So he's loading a rifle that turned out to be a Ruger Mini 14?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. So they spot that. They figure out that something bad is probably about to happen, and we will talk some more about that when we get back from the break. We're going to discuss what happened when the FBI initiated the stop. Also, some of the things that occurred that made that turn out a little worse for them than it could have. But anyway, right now you are listening to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station.
Be wealthy and wise. The Steve Perrin Coordinated Financial Planning Studios. This is 55 KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55 KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. We are discussing the 1986 FBI Miami firefight with law enforcement officer John Hearn, one of the top researchers on the subject that I have met. So that's kind of a backhanded. No, he's one of the most knowledgeable guys about this that I've ran into. So anyway, we've got John back on the line. John, are you there?
I'm still here.
Excellent. So we've got FBI agents that are tracking down a duo of hyper-violent bank robbers, murderers, kidnappers, and they've just made contact with them and see that one of the suspects is loading a long gun. So what happens next?
Well, this is where I think it's really important to actually visit the location where these things happened, because I never understood their decision to make the stop when they did until I actually went into the location where this gunfight took place. Basically, what happened was they had to make a decision that I think of a lot of us, maybe as adults, appreciate. They had to pick which option sucked less.
Right.
The main road out there was a heavily congested urban highway, high volume of morning traffic. Again, it is just 9:17 in the morning. And where they ended up by just turning off a road is they were in a very nice upscale neighborhood with very large lots, so you have a low population density. And along one side of the road, kind of to the right as they're driving down, is a very, very large wall that proceeds for about two blocks in length. So I think they were thinking, and I immediately thought, hey, that's a great backstop.
Right.
So I think it just came down to a matter of if they had waited for all their agents to get on scene, the bad guys would have ended out in a much more urban area. So I think the FBI basically made a decision to shift all the danger and the risk onto themselves in order to prevent the bad guys who they knew were armed with long guns at this point from getting out into a more public venue.
Right, and that's actually really quick and intelligent thinking on the fly like that, especially knowing that you're probably about to walk into a gunfight. So what occurs? They've picked this location because it favors less people getting hurt. What occurs next?
Well, they go and initiate their, what we would call, I guess, their takedown. And as I understand it, I believe the plan was they were going to box the suspects in, bring the vehicle to a stop, and attempt to arrest them. And as part of that, one of the vehicles with two agents in it, Agents Hamlin and Morales, basically pulled up alongside the bad guy's car. And this is where things really, really start to go wrong, because the bad guys did something which wasn't really expected, which is the bad guys began to engage the two agents that were immediately adjacent to them.
Okay.
In order to protect those agents, the agent immediately behind the bad guys rammed the cars at the same time that they were beginning to contact. So you've got a bunch of collision forces going on here, and basically the bad guy's car kind of makes a great big U-turn. The car that was on the outside kind of skids off into the dirt, and you basically end up with this huge cloud of dust with the bad guys somehow emerging out of it and then just having made a great big U-turn.
Okay.
To prevent the bad guys from escaping, one of the FBI agents, Agent Manalvi, basically plows his car into theirs and forces it off to the road where it comes to rest in front of a residential duplex area.
Okay. So the cars are all stopped. We've got two bad guys that are armed with long guns. The FBI agents, are they armed with long guns, or what do they have?
They have a mix of armaments. At the time, the only FBI agents that were allowed to carry semi-automatic pistols were the SWAT-trained guys. And at the time this took place, the three SWAT-trained agents were actually on scene with them. So I'm sure they thought that their heavy hitters were already there already.
Right.
So you have three agents armed with the Smith & Wesson 459s. Everybody else is armed with some variation of a six-shot revolver or a five-shot if they're carrying it as a backup gun. And there were two Remington 870s on the scene as well.
Okay. So mainly pistols, though.
But primarily pistols.
Okay. So what occurs next? We've got this big car wreck, pretty much. We've got two bad guys that are trying to get out of the car. We've got FBI agents that are debussing. What occurs?
Well, the gunfight begins immediately and pretty much forthwith. As soon as Agent Manalvi rams their kind of the vehicle to rest, he is immediately placed under fire, that is 223 rifle fire, from a distance of probably about 3 yards away. He ends up bailing out of his car. Manages to escape with what I guess you would call secondary wounds from the fragments and stuff like that. But he had unfortunately drawn his pistol earlier, put it underneath his leg in order to have it available more quickly. So after the collision, it's lost, and he has to basically run away from the gunfight and hide for the rest of it, unfortunately.
Because he just wasn't armed, period,
that point. His gun was later found in the passenger side floorboard of his car.
Okay. So we've got him. He's trying to evade rifle fire. What are the other FBI agents doing?
At this time, the other FBI agents are arriving on scene. The next guy in is Gordon McNeil. He's the supervisor, and as he's actually rolling in into his car, he immediately starts taking 223 fire as well. So literally, the rounds are peeing off his car before he can even come to a stop. About the same time, Agents Grogan and Dove are kind of pulling up behind the vehicle, maybe at about a 7 o'clock angle on the bad guy's car.
Okay.
McNeil exits his vehicle, basically fires four rounds from his service handgun. He is then struck in his dominant hand by a .223 round. In one of those quirky little things, he said he looked at it, wiggled his fingers, realized everything was still working, so he dropped the revolver back on the hood of the car and continued to fire. His next two shots actually hit Maddox, who was in the driver's seat. The first one is a great shot. It hits Maddox in the head. The second one, for our purposes, is probably even better because it hits him in the shoulder and actually hits the brachial nerve, which pretty much disabled second round hits him in the shoulder and does a pretty good bit of damage.
Okay. So, and at that point, he's out of the fight, pretty much.
At that point, yeah, what happens, I think that McNeil, backtrack for one second here, he basically fires the four rounds, and while he's checking his hands, Rogan and Dove are engaging him behind. Rogan and Dove manage to put a round on Maddox, who had leaned out of the car to fire his shotgun. He takes a round in the arm, and while he's looking down at that arm wound is when McNeil will place the two rounds that have so much effect on him.
Okay, so one bad guy at this point, then.
Yeah, effectively.
Okay, so what happens next?
At this point, two other FBI agents kind of arrive and kind of cut off the north end. Platt realizes that the predicament that he's in, so he has to exit his vehicle. Now, he's really, really kind of smushed, for lack of a better word, between the cars and these collisions, so there's no way for him to open the door.
All right.
So what he does is he tries to crawl out of the window, and as he's crawling out the window, we get probably one of the most unfortunate or infamous shots in law enforcement history. He's crawling out of the window. Dove lines up, fires a good shot that is absolutely devastating. It's the wound that will eventually kill him. And obviously he's not stopped. He continues to crawl out of the car and is actually hit two more times in the legs as he tries to get out of the line of fire.
Okay. And that was with, and this is the famous 9mm doesn't work that well. Is where everyone draws that conclusion is based off of this one incident.
Quite possibly. And not just this shot, but probably another shot probably showed some failings, at least in some particular loadings of 9mm.
Right, right. And I'm personally a huge 9mm fan, but for the purpose of the mid-80s, this starts the whole 10mm and then 40 caliber phase.
Yes.
Later on. So anyway, continue. It's a shot that causes massive blood loss but does not stop him immediately.
Yes, it does. And like I said, this is the wound that will eventually kill him, according to the coroner.
Okay.
But realistically, at the time he takes that wound, he is only lightly wounded two FBI agents at this point in time. He hasn't killed anybody yet.
All right. So, and we'll try and just go through this as quick as we can so we have enough time. So we have this gunfight. We have one mobile bad guy that, what damage does he do after he takes that shot that didn't stop him?
Basically, after he rolls across into the car, he exchanges fires kind of with two different groups of FBI agents. He is actually wounded in the arm in this process and actually loses the use of his thumb in that process. But unfortunately, he doesn't lose the use of his trigger finger.
Right.
In the course of exchanging fire with the agents, he's actually hit a second time. Agent Reisner across the street manages to plant a beautiful 30-plus yard shot on him. This is while the bad guy is standing sideways, so you and I both know that was not an easy shot.
No.
But basically he's able to hunker down and drop down behind cover where he's pretty much invisible. He gets his rifle reloaded, and at which point he attacks the agents that are kind of securing the south end of the perimeter where Grogan and Dove are.
All right, so how effective is that attack that he places on the agents?
Well, that's an absolutely devastating attack. You've got, at this point, Grogan and Dove are fighting from their position. These are, again, two SWAT-trained agents with their 459s. Agent Hanlon and Morales, who won that earlier collision, have now split up and are trying to assist the mutual agents involved in this. But basically what Platt does is begins to simply fire and maneuver on the agents that are blocking his escape to the south.
Okay.
He basically forces Dove to abandon his position. Dove has expired all the rounds that he has on his person. You know, his actual service pistol, once it's empty, takes a 223 round to it, which to my mind would probably be to move somewhere else.
Right.
But Platt continues to maneuver on the FBI agents. As he gets better angles on the agents, he just simply continues to lay down fire with the 223. He hits Hanlon multiple times. When he gets an angle on Grogan, who's fighting from the rear trunk of the vehicle, he puts rounds on him. When he works his way around the corner of the car, he finds Dove there on the ground. And actually shoots Dove twice in the chest, and when Dove tries to get up again, shoots him twice in the head with the 223.
All right, so at that point, Dove is killed.
Yes, he's killed right there at that time.
All right. So, and all the while, our bad guy is bleeding lethally. It'll kill him at some point from a wound that was placed earlier. But he's still continuing to fight just because he made the decision that he wasn't going to give up, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, he was a graduate of Ranger School, which is one of the hardest military schools that we really have. So he definitely had the hardness and the mindset squared away for this fight.
Right. So we've got another 30 seconds. We're talking with John Hearn about the 1986 FBI Miami gunfight. 25 seconds. What happens next? Just give him a teaser.
The bad guys almost make it. Platt is about to steal the FBI's car, and his companion Maddox, who has actually been shot very solidly in the head, is still up and moving around and in the game.
Okay. So we're going to discuss what happens next with John Hearn, just still talking about the FBI Miami gunfight. But right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station.
Hi, it's Brian Thomas, Monday in the Morning Show. Dad will be on at 7:05, venting his spleen. Yep, spleen vent Mondays. Tune in at 7:05.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Right now, we are talking with John Hearn about the 1986 FBI Miami gunfight. Not going to open the phone lines up just yet because there's a couple more things we're going to cover. But I'll throw the number out in a little bit when we get done. So, John, are you still there?
I am still here.
Excellent. So we've got the two bad guys are now trying to steal an FBI vehicle and make their escape. We've got at least one dead FBI agent. What happens next?
At this point, Agent Morales, who had actually been wounded by Platt earlier in the fight, realizes what's about to happen, and he grows concerned that in the process of escaping that Platt and Maddox are going to run over his friends, which are all kind of circled around the back of the car. So what he does is, in what's really brilliant, is manages to improvise the function of his 870 with just one hand. He hadn't been formally trained in this and was actually able to kind of figure this out in the midst of one of the most famous gunfights of the 20th century. He basically starts to engage the bad guys, fires five rounds from his Remington 870, doesn't hit them, but certainly gets their attention.
Right.
This forces Platt to leave the vehicle. Platt walks out, fires three rounds at Morales at literally point-blank range, misses him with all three shots, and then tries to get back into the vehicle to escape. Morales, at this point, he said he was afraid he was going to pass out, basically draws his service revolver and charges the car with the bad guys in it. Morales will finish the fight by engaging the two bad guys with three rounds each from his service revolver.
Okay, and that how effective are those three rounds?
Well, despite being fired at almost point-blank range, again, we see a lot of failed headshots here. Basically, by the time that these pistol bullets, you know, they're 158-grain plus P-38 specials, are trying to get through the big bones of the skull, they're just not really doing a good job. And probably, I think it was one round, and each bad guy was able to hit something valuable. But we literally have rounds kind of screeching to a halt right before the spine and literally not doing anything, just stopping short of the mark, as it were.
Okay. So, but those one round each, that ends the fight?
Yeah, they took multiple rounds, but they basically each took a devastating wound in that process. For lack of better words, I guess the way to think about it is that they're kind of knocked unconscious. So they can't continue any further aggression, and they basically have time to bleed out at that point.
And just to be clear there, so these are headshots that don't immediately kill them. They just knock them unconscious, at which point they expire from wounds they took previous.
Yes.
Okay.
Maddox took a pretty good hit to the spine that actually would have probably completely paralyzed him, but basically the other rounds just kind of take them out of the fight long enough for the blood to leak out.
Okay. So the fight's over at that point. Where's the tally stand?
At this point, obviously, both bad guys are about to succumb from their wounds, but the FBI has actually lost two of its special agents killed. Three of them are seriously wounded. Two of them are lightly wounded, and only one agent actually comes out of this thing completely unscathed.
Okay. So for the purposes of law enforcement, a pretty devastating loss.
Absolutely.
Okay. So after this gunfight's over, we've got a lot of – and obviously, folks, we – condensed this as much as we possibly could. John gives an excellent lecture that when I took it was about 2 hours, and there was still, you know, things that were left out. if you want to do more research about this, there are ways to go about that. But so afterwards, a lot of things are brought up. There were a lot of failings in tactics and also some of the bureaucracy involved as far as before the fight.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people tend to view this event as some big screw-up by the FBI, when in reality, like I said earlier, it was just kind of a matter of picking the options that sucked less.
Right.
They very deliberately shifted the danger on themselves to protect the public and really paid a high price for that. Realistically, the FBI's marksmanship was not that horrible in this event. I didn't touch on that earlier, but when these cars started to stack up, you created a very 3D environment with a bunch of very narrow, limited shooting lanes.
Right.
So in addition to these narrow shooting lanes that are created by the cars, you may only see a bad guy literally for a second. There's also this huge amount of dust in the air from the wreck. The bad guys came to rest underneath a very big shade tree. So you've got a very bright spring morning. So it's very dark underneath the tree. The bad guys are wearing dark clothes. They're really largely invisible, except when they're, you know, visible for an instant. So the FBI had some very, very difficult shooting problems to try to solve in the midst of all this.
All right. So from a marksmanship standpoint, they did about as well as you can expect given the situation.
Yeah, I think there was, some agents did better than others, obviously.
Right.
But there were some remarkable feats of marksmanship carried out in this. You know, Reisner was able to hit Platt from more than 30 yards away while he was turned in profile. That's some very, very good shooting.
Yes, extremely. Not long-range marksmanship, not my favorite thing, especially with a handgun. So if we can't point to marksmanship as a problem here, where did the breakdown occur? I mean, obviously, they created a situation to prevent the public from being injured as much as they could that put them at a tactical disadvantage. But, I mean, why were more long guns not utilized or some other things? What's your takeaways from this?
Well, I think it's just the nature of having to work in a large bureaucratic organization, not necessarily just the FBI, but any large organization suffers from these problems. Basically, these guys had access to long guns. They could have gotten M16s, MP5s, the Remington 870s, that sort of thing. But it was an understanding that if one of those guns was stolen, no matter how, I guess, legitimately it might have been stolen, no matter how it was secured when it was lost, that was going to be a career-ending move.
Okay.
So these guys are, you know, kind of having to sit here and literally every day pick, you know, an option of, you know, getting a long gun that might save my life in a, what was probably viewed as a low probability event versus a sure career-ending decision if that long gun happened to get stolen.
All right. And, you know, if a vehicle gets lost, something of that nature, I guess that was, it could have happened.
Yeah. And I think the other problem, just with, you know, institutionally is that, you know, every one of these agents was qualified, you know, to the Bureau of Standards at the time. But that qualification, you know, 70% of your rounds in an FBI, you know, bowling pin, what we would call a Q target, that was completely removed from what those guys had to pull off that day.
Right.
Realistically, they needed a much higher standard of marksmanship that most agencies aren't going to be willing to require of their people.
Just because it costs too much to train them to that level?
It costs too much. We're going to have to accept the fact that some people are going to fail. And agencies don't like to fail police officers nowadays for poor marksmanship.
Yeah, it's there's a big online discussion about that recently. You probably saw it too. Now, I'm curious. So aside from they could have checked long guns out, but they didn't because it was possibly career ending if something happened in the long gun. A lot of people pointed to specifically there was a 115 grain 9mm silver tip that did not penetrate deeply enough, supposedly, and that's why the fight lasted as long as it did. So what do we get the FBI doing after this as far as any studies or?
Well, this completely, you know, the Bureau took a very hard look at this fight. They tried very hard to learn from their lessons learned from it, and they came up with their now standard protocols for testing ammunition. They started to move toward rounds that penetrated a lot deeper. You know, you're looking for that magic 12 to 18 inches in 10% ordnance gelatin, which has pretty much become an industry standard nowadays.
Right. So, and that was, I think, Yuri Patrick that did that study. Correct me if I'm wrong, but handgun wounding factors and effectiveness, I want to say, came out a couple years afterwards, which is really the birth of modern terminal ballistics, I would imagine, wouldn't you?
Absolutely. They have definitely come up with some protocols that have largely stood the test of time.
All right. So aside from that, we get a focus on hardware problems that occurred. Do you find it interesting at all that when they're trying to figure out what went wrong. They start talking about hardware issues, but they don't really cover some of the training.
Well, I think that's because we can always go out and buy the latest trinket to solve our problems as opposed to doing the hard work to that's probably going to be required to solve the problem.
Right.
It's human nature, I guess, for lack of better words.
Yeah, well, I mean, I get it. It's not always fun to train. We'll talk about that a little bit more, if you don't mind staying on for the next segment. We'll talk about some of the things that they did differently afterwards. Also, how this affected future gunfights, and specifically, I'm going to bring up the North Hollywood shootout. Right now, though, you're listening to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station.
Glenn Beck.
This will blow your mind.
Tomorrow at 9:06 on 55KRC, the talk station.
Welcome back to Ballistic Radio on 55KRC, the talk station, brought to you by Kyle's Gun Shop in Finneytown. Right now, we're talking with John Hurt about the 1986 FBI Miami gunfight. If you have any questions for me or John about the gunfight or anything else that comes to mind, we might have time for one or two calls at the end of the show. You can reach us at 513-749-5500 or 1-800-823-8255. But without further ado, John, are you still there?
I am still here.
So the gunfight's over. We were just discussing before the break how a lot of attention was paid to some hardware problems, specifically equipment failings or things of that nature, not so much the training as far as maybe the tactics they used and what their qualification course looked like before the event?
Oh, yeah, I would say so.
All right. Another thing that was interesting to me, and this is sort of tangential, but I thought I'd bring it up. We were discussing long guns and why they didn't have them, and you mentioned the bureaucracy of if they lost a long gun, their career would be over. Now, about 11 years later, we had the North Hollywood shootout, and everyone seems very surprised that none of the immediate responding police officers have long guns. Do you think that there's a corollary that could be drawn between not paying attention to maybe some of the lessons that were learned 11 years earlier?
Well, I think most law enforcement agencies are really, really hesitant to change a public or a procedure unless it happens in their district. You know, when they responded to North Hollywood, those officers responding had long guns. They had Remington 870 shotguns, but they only had buckshot for them.
Right.
So buckshot at a threat 75 yards away just wasn't much use.
Yes.
And it actually took a lot. You know, it was if you talk to the guys with LAPD, it took a lot longer than, I believe it was 97 for North Hollywood. It took a lot longer than that. You know, they didn't magically roll out patrol rifles the next day. It took them a long time to actually get that program going.
Yeah, I was just
with it.
Go ahead.
Actually, I'm familiar with another big city PD that bought a bunch of ARs, some up properly, and literally had them sit in the vault for about 3 years, ready to go with the training program, ready to go. And they didn't, but nobody wanted to sign off on the program itself, and so they ended up with a bunch of cars shot up in a very North Hollywood-esque event. And it actually took it happening in their jurisdiction for that to actually happen.
Do you think that's just a common failing everywhere as far as not wanting to really think about realistic training or realistic requirements for what you might find yourself in?
I think it's a very, very tough call for an agency to basically be willing to lack of a better word, call people because they just simply can't shoot well.
Right.
A police officer can spend a very small part of his career actually shooting somebody, but if it comes down to that moment, it's an incredibly crucial thing.
Yeah.
And most departments just kind of have a very risk-averse attitude, let's say, when it comes to dealing with these issues.
Okay. I'll kind of swing it around. Right now we're talking with John Hearn about the 1986 FBI Miami gunfight, some of the lessons learned, some of the ways that it changed things. If you have any questions for us, you can get a hold of us at 513-749-5500. Or if you're one of the people listening live online, 1-800-823-8255. Now, and we'll go back to the FBI gunfight. What do you think that in your research that you've noticed not brought up that much as far as the aftermath of the gunfight? I mean, has there been anything that has stood out to you that you find interesting people don't think about after the fact or talk about much?
I think my biggest takeaway from this is how quickly we are willing to forget these lessons learned. I do this presentation in my Newhall presentation at a bunch of different training venues around the country, and literally there are people that have not heard, of either one of these fights.
Right.
It's really scary in that, you know, this Miami FBI gunfight was not unprecedented. You know, the U.S. Marshal Service had a gunfight with Gordon Call 2 years previously, where two of the bad guys had mini 14s.
Okay.
And, you know, like I said, people are just seem very, very hesitant to make dramatic changes such as patrol rifles and issuing semi-automatic weapons to people. There's just this huge institutional, lack of momentum to prevent these kind of things.
All right. We'll kind of swing it around to the civilian side of things a little bit. And I know we didn't originally plan on this, but we've got a little bit of extra time. Along that same vein, do you think that people in general, as far as the – and obviously painting with a broad brush is difficult to do and probably not intelligent, but talk radio, I can do that if I want to. Do you think people don't have enough of a realistic expectation of what they're capable of and what their equipment's capable of?
I don't think people realize just how far the human body can be pushed and how well they can perform. The problem is that requires a good bit of preparation beforehand to kind of have all the pieces in place to make that happen. You know, it really is amazing to look at the damage that Platt took and how much blood he lost, but he was still fighting. You know, they put an ET tube and tried to start an IV in him, you know, 20 minutes after the gunfight was over, which meant that he still had a pulse and was still breathing.
Right. And that's after he'd been shot quite a number of times at that point,
12
right?
12 times.
12 times?
Yeah, 12 times at that point.
Jeez. what do you think, as far as, and we've even seen this recently as far as with the Nairobi mall shooting, do you think that, what are some areas that people should be examining in their own maybe training regimen or carry gear that would be applicable to kind of one of those low percentage but really important events?
I think probably the biggest thing is the ability to make a precision shot, whether that's making a head shot at 5 yards or making a full torso shot at 30 yards. Nobody likes to practice the precision at distance or up close, you know, any form of precision because they make them look bad.
Right.
You know, bullseye targets have really fallen out of favor in training circles, but I personally think that bullseye is a great way to learn sights and trigger. You know, you can't fake sights and trigger on a bullseye target. It tells on you every time.
Right. Right. And that's actually interesting you bring it up. The reason we didn't have a show last week was because I was out taking armed movement instructors from Craig Douglas. I know you're familiar with that. For the people that are not, though, you're pretty much running around inside of a building with, depending on the venue, semi-munitions or airsoft. We had airsoft at this one. What I found interesting, though, I'd practice at least once a week. I probably shoot somewhere between 1,000 and 2,000 rounds a month, which is a lot by most people's standards. And the shots that I was missing inside of, you know, 15 or 20 feet was incredible to me. As far as, you know, it's just, do you think that the people would be better served by kind of experimenting with what they're capable of under pressure? Maybe.
Absolutely. I think anytime you're, you know, forcing yourself to work under pressure, you're going to do good. I think that the curse that everybody has is that everybody wants a perfect replication of a gunfight, and it's just not out there. I think competition can have some value in that way. You know, any kind of, you know, structured, with a heavy emphasis on structured force on force, is really going to push you out of your comfortable boundaries, and it's certainly going to get you out of that mindset of, you know, shooting at a target 3 yards away and drawing and looking really cool and shooting really tight groups. That's, you know, that's not what a real gunfight is going to look like.
Yeah, there's a lot of ouch, I don't want to get shot involved. So I'm curious too. Now, you've got, speaking of tight accuracy standards, and we'll kind of, you actually work on some targets yourself, don't you?
Yeah, I invented a series of targets kind of as part of the Rangemaster Tactical Conference. We weren't really happy with the targets we had for that venue, so I invented what we call the Hardhead TED target. It's basically a 3D reactive target that's actually affordable for most folks, and it can you know, be made with some fairly rigid hit zones there.
Okay. As far as how does that work, as far as it's three-dimensional, do you mind, we've got another minute and a half, and I'd kind of like to tell people about it, because when I saw it, it was actually really cool. So
I welcome the opportunity to plug. Basically, what I did was I took two classic designs, kind of the Tac-Man target that's been out since the 90s and a Pepper Popper, and I kind of figured out a way to put the two together. So
okay.
Basically, I faced a Pepper Popper with a 3D target, and I've really cut the portion of what we would think of as a Pepper Popper down to a much more reasonable anatomical shape, you know, 8-inch circle, 10-inch circle. I do an 8x5 for Tom Givens because he's devious.
Right.
And basically the only time the target will actually go down is when you hit those proper areas. So you can literally shoot the guy in the abdomen all day long, and he's just going to kind of stand there and look at you. But if you actually plant a hit in that vital area, you know, between the suprasternal notch, the xiphoid process, and between the nipples, the target's going to go down, just kind of like real people do.
Right. And for those that don't know, a pepper popper would be just a metal plate that's kind of on a pole that
hinge.
On a hinge that will fall over when you strike it solidly. Still there, John?
I'm still here.
Yeah.
And I do have a website, and that's www.dvc, like Delta Victor Charlie, target.com.
Excellent.
If anybody wants any more information on that.
All right, perfect. Hey, John, I really appreciate you coming on the show tonight and talking about the gunfight. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to discuss all the details, but thanks again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Hey, no problem. I hope you enjoy the rest of your Sunday. So, next week, we were going to have one guest on that unfortunately had to canceled due to their scheduling issues, but I have adapted and overcome, and we're going to be having Todd Green back on the show. Todd Green is the gentleman that runs PistolTraining.com, PistolForum.com. We're going to be talking about some things like his 1911 9mm and how it's holding up after 50,000 rounds, maybe his charity as well. Make sure you check out our website, BallisticRadio.com, and like our Facebook page at Facebook.com/BallisticRadio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe and see you next Sunday at 7 p.m. right here on 55 KRC, the talk station.